Good evening, all. Welcome to Behind the News for June 17, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two interviews lined up for tonight. First one with a Malaysian economist who goes by the name Jomo, and I'll give you fuller details on his naming conventions in a moment. He's a professor at the University of Malaya, and we'll be talking about the economic and political scene in East Asia, 7 years after the Asian financial crisis. And then a little after the half hour, we'll be speaking with Seth Kleinman, who is an economist with PFC Energy, about what's going on with oil. Why is oil so expensive, or why has oil prices come off their peaks? What's with the supply and demand situation? Is it a hoax? Is it a plot? Is it psychology? What is it? And we hope to emerge the wiser when the 6 o'clock hour hits. And before we get to those interviews, just an announcement first. The Brecht Forum, sometimes known as the New York Marxist School, is doing its annual summer intensive study of Marxism, Thursday, July 8th through Sunday, July 11th. If you've always wanted to figure out the difference between absolute and relative surplus value, that's the place to go. The Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor. You can, for more about their summer intensive study of Marxism, you can either call the Brecht Forum, which is at 212-242-4201, or visit their website at Brecht Forum, that's all one word, brechtforum.org. That's the summer intensive on Marxism. What does democracy have to do with it? Marx and democracy is the focus of this year's summer intensive. So, again, this year's summer intensive on Marxism, Brecht Forum in Manhattan. You can call 212-242-4201 or visit brechtforum.org for more details. And now, just a look at a few of the economic headlines, since time is a little tight. The Conference Board's package of leading indicators, which are supposed to foretell twists and turns in the U.S. economy, rose a half a point in May, continuing a pretty strong performance over the last several months, and portending continued economic expansion in the United States in the coming months. This indicator isn't perfect, but it does have a pretty good record, so the odds are in favor of continuing economic expansion. Released this morning, a tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance. A very timely and sensitive indicator of what's going on in the job market. That fell by 15,000, and the number of people continuing to draw unemployment benefits, that is a measure of the longer-term unemployed, that also fell by 31,000. So it's up from recent lows, but still reasonably healthy reading. It's not as vibrant as it could be, but the labor market in the U.S. does seem to be continuing its recovery, which began several months ago. Wall Street and people around it are worried about inflation. They can't decide how serious this scare is. Oil prices, as we'll talk about later, have been leading the way higher, but other basic commodity prices have also been acting almost as if it's the 1970s again. Well, not quite, but a little feel of that those inflationary days, and it's not yet really filtered through to wages or broader commodity inflation, but a lot of panic among some people on Wall Street that this is about to happen, and they're urging the Federal Reserve to tighten rather more aggressively than I think the Fed is likely to tighten. I think the Fed is still concerned about the durability of the economic recovery and vulnerabilities in the financial system, and they're going to be very cautious about pushing interest rates higher. But some people on Wall Street are getting nervous about inflation scares, both consumer prices and wholesale prices, showing some signs of life, although not across the board. So not easy to read, but does seem to be some sign of inflationary pressures in the system. The University of Michigan's monthly survey of consumer attitudes was the preliminary reading for May. They'll come out with a final reading in a couple of weeks. Up 5 points in June, rather. The preliminary value for June was 95, up from May's reading of 90. So that does show improving consumer attitudes, but that's contradicted by the weekly numbers coming from ABC News and Money Magazine, which have now at 12-week lows. They've been falling for four straight weeks, so it's not we can't really figure out how to reconcile this contradiction. Some measures showing improving optimism, some showing lingering pessimism, or even deteriorating perceptions. It may be political evaluations coloring people's view of the economy. It also does seem to be a big difference between the way richer people see things and the way poorer people see things, with richer people thinking the economy is doing pretty well and poorer folks thinking that's not the case. Elsewhere, the Argentine economic recovery continues. That country has now clocked its third consecutive quarter of GDP growth in the double digits. Released earlier today, just a few hours ago, nearly 11% growth in the first quarter of this year. The previous readings were 12 and 10.3, so... And then before that, a mere 7.5. So Argentina does seem to be recovering, though slowly, from its deep economic crisis of several years ago. I say slowly because even though the GDP numbers are looking good, it's really taking a longer time to reach down to actual people. The unemployment rate remains pretty sticky. It's down from its highs, but it's still in a 14-15% area, which is still way too high. And now, an interview I recorded yesterday with the Malaysian economist Jomo, whose full name is Jomo Kwame Sundaram, which he says is a mouthful, so he shortens that to either Jomo KS or even just Jomo, as he's known professionally. And he's a professor at the University of Malaya and chair of the International Development Economics Associates, IDEAS is its abbreviation. And I talked with him about he was in town for a UN conference, so he stopped by yesterday to talk about the state of the East Asian economy 7 years after the Southeast Asian financial crisis. So let's listen to Jomo. Let's first talk about what's happened in the 7 years now since the East Asian financial crisis. I think most Americans stopped paying attention as soon as the immediate flames of the crisis burned out. But what's the recovery been like across the region?
Contrary to many expectations, both in the market as well as the International Monetary Fund, East Asia recovered rather sharply in 1999 and 2000 after a very bad year in 1998. But since then, the economic performance in the region has been variable, largely because many of the East Asian economies are very intimately linked with the U.S. economy and with the bursting of the dot-com bubble and the slowdown in the U.S. economy in 2001, East Asian economies were very adversely affected as well. Since then, there has been a recovery since the second half of last year in different parts of East Asia, particularly in Southeast Asia. Throughout this period, however, Korea has been the outstanding performer, besides China, of course, and both those economies have continued to grow rather strongly since the late 1990s, despite the East Asian financial crisis.
And what's been driving Korean growth? Exports, internal demand, or a combination of both?
A combination of both. Internal demand has largely picked up, initially due to the financial stimulus, which came from the fiscal deficit, which the Korean government ran in the late 1990s. But subsequently, consumer demand has picked up domestically. But very importantly, Korea has emerged very much in its own right on a number of technological fronts. The Hyundai, for example, is now ahead of Honda. The Koreans have been able to produce a number of mobile phones and quite a number of other consumer items, which have captured, which have made significant inroads in different markets overseas.
Yeah, I replaced my Nokia with a Samsung recently, so I've joined the trend. The Koreans have also discovered credit cards, haven't they?
Well, the credit cards were very, very liberally and generously handed out after the crisis to try to stimulate the recovery. Of course, this had also happened before the crisis with disastrous consequences, but it was also used as one means to try to increase consumer demand after the crisis when things were rather depressed.
And has Korea been able to move up? Well, you alluded to this already. They've been successful at moving up the technological ladder.
Yes, Korea has done so much more successfully than Taiwan, partly because Korea has this developed very large and sometimes diversified industrial conglomerates called jaibols, reminiscent of some of the pre-war Japanese industrial conglomerates at that time called zaibatsu. And these have been successfully deployed very effectively to sort of lead the whole Korean growth process. They got rather distracted from the late 1980s with financial liberalization, and they began to experiment with a lot of the new financial instruments to try to make money on the financial front rather than focus on the industrial front. But since the crisis, I think they've gone back and focused much more sharply on their earlier industrial and technological areas of strength.
And during the crisis, and immediately after, there was a lot of talk about how Korea had to break up the chaebol, open up the financial markets, adopt American-style standards of corporate governance, which now in retrospect look pretty ridiculous. How much of that agenda was adopted, or did the Koreans successfully evade that advice?
It's quite interesting to note that some of the people who are most influential with both the last government and this government are precisely advocates of greater transparency for the jaibols. The jaibols certainly enjoyed tremendous privileges under the military regimes and then in the early post-military regimes, and have been the object of a great deal of resentment by Korean public at large. However, the jaibols have also been the leaders of the whole industrialization process, especially after the jaibols sort of are seen to have abused the privileges they had by being primarily responsible for the financial vulnerability of the Korean economy in 97-98. They have been forced to concede some of their privileges. So they are not as privileged as they were before, but it's precisely because of their earlier privileges and their ability to utilize those privileges to develop certain industrial and technological strengths that they are now less reliant on political access. And so to some extent, it would be fair to say that the Korean jaibols are now much more accountable to not only to Korean shareholders but also to the public at large. So what we are seeing is a movement away from the old privileges of the jaibols but towards a stakeholder economy rather than a Western Anglo-American style shareholder type accountability. So there are interesting reforms in Korean corporate governance, but not exactly in the direction which was being insisted upon by particularly by some by the World Bank and to a lesser extent by the OECD.
And of course the US Treasury and Wall Street.
Of course.
Korea has also historically had a very active and militant labor movement. How does that figure into the picture?
The labor movement has probably achieved the highest level of its success ever in the current period. President No made his career as a labor lawyer and was basically not even considered to be a viable presidential candidate until a few weeks before the actual election, and he didn't have a parliamentary majority until recently when he broke away from the original ruling party and formed his own party, which successfully performed in the recent elections. So he is now firmly in power. His strength is largely derived from the trade unions. So to some extent, the trade unions have become part of mainstream politics, and hence their militancy has been tempered by this new role and this new influence which they have in the body politic in Korea. But it's precisely because of this that Korea is probably unique in East Asia in actually having achieved and institutionalized some very important social reforms. So while the rest of East Asia has seen a significant erosion of labor rights, of welfare rights, and so on and so forth. It is only in Korea that these rights have actually been advanced, albeit modestly, in the recent period.
Let's talk a bit about what's been going on in the rest of the region, and what's happened with these setbacks in social rights and social development that you're talking to. Why is Korea doing so much better than everyone else, and what's happening in the rest of the region?
Well, the main reason Korea has done better is precisely because of the strength of the labor movement and the public pressure for democratization over the last couple of decades, over the last few decades, and this has initially resulted in the election in late 1997 of Kim Dae-jung, who had always been a leader of the opposition but never been able to break through and win the presidency. But Kim Dae-jung's reform agenda was rather limited because he had become very much captured by the system. President Noh, however, came from, in a sense, the left fringe of the Kim Dae-jung party, and through fortuitous circumstances won the presidency but was not able to exercise effective leadership until fairly recently. And it's precisely therefore because of democratization and the growing strength of the labor movement that Korea has been able to make some gains. And it's also has meant that you have an interesting sort of social contract which is very much alive in Korea between organized labor and big business, not unlike what we could see during the so-called golden age in Europe, for example, during the 50s and the 1960s. In the rest of East Asia, however, in places like Japan and so on, where there's been economic stagnation or very, very slow growth, there has been an erosion of labor and welfare rights in recent years, a strong pressure to conform to Anglo-American standards in terms of the reorganization of the financial sector, which had disastrous initial results, the so-called financial big bang, which was responsible for the slowdown of the Japanese economy in the 1990s and continues to plague the Japanese economy to the present. In the rest of East Asia, however, which continued to have rapid growth until the crisis of 1997-98, we have not seen any significant democratization of these polities, except perhaps in Taiwan. And arguably in Indonesia. And so as a consequence, and without the presence of a strong labor movement in most of these economies, there has not been any significant democratization. There has not been any significant gain in terms of social rights, particularly labor rights, but even rights of other sectors of the population. And if anything, there has been the converse, mainly due to the spread of an ideology of economic liberalization, including what is called labor market flexibility, which has often meant the erosion of hard-won labor rights from an earlier period. And of course, in China, many of the rights which were part of the old regime have been very much eroded by the diminution of the state-owned sector on the one hand, and the erosion of labor rights for workers more generally.
I'm speaking with Jomo K.S., a Malaysian economist visiting New York, about economic and political developments in East Asia. Let's talk about China a bit. The influence of China seems very large, but also contradictory. On the one hand, it's a formidable competitor driving down prices and wages, which can undermine established companies and countries and wage standards. On the other hand, it's also growing very rapidly, provides tremendous economic demand for the rest of the region and a good bit of the rest of the world. So how does China's influence play out across East Asia? Is it a positive, is it negative, a mix of the two?
It certainly is very much of a mix in the sense that China has undoubtedly emerged as the world's factory, and it's producing an increasingly broader range of products. Until the 90s, one might have argued that China was mainly involved in fairly low-skilled manufacturing, but China's new capabilities suggest increasingly that China is competitive on a broad range of fronts. For example, the most efficient steel producer in the world today is actually in China, a state-owned enterprise known as Bao Steel. So China has demonstrated growing capabilities on a broad range of fronts, but because of continued huge unemployment, China has been able to increase labor productivity without many of the gains of increased productivity accruing to workers. And so this has meant that the gains from increased labor productivity have accrued to consumers, both domestic Chinese consumers and consumers all over the world. Domestically, therefore, we have a very curious phenomenon of very rapid growth in China, but consumer price deflation. Now, Japan, of course, also had consumer price deflation, but that was in a situation of economic stagnation. In China, you have rapid growth, close to double digits sometimes, but consumer price deflation because of how the wages do not rise and labor productivity is results in higher profitability on the one hand, as well as lower consumer prices.
A lot of people on the American left, a lot of people in the American labor movement would like to punish China somehow with tariffs or some other kinds of trade barriers in the interest of raising labor standards in China. What do you feel about that approach?
I'm not sure this is particularly fruitful. I mean, the part of the reason why China is in this situation, of course, is due to government policies in China itself. But part of it, of course, has been the successful efforts by international institutions in which the American government is dominant in terms of its policy influence to push for economic liberalization and labor flexibility. And the consequence of this, of course, is that China has been the most successful, but certainly not the only low-cost producer in the world. And unless one begins to deal with the consequences of this policy at source, and one has to recognize that the source is Washington rather than Beijing. The fact of the matter remains that wages for Chinese workers working for Chinese manufacturers based in China are certainly not lower than for other workers in China, and sometimes maybe even slightly higher. So I think many of the claims being made about Chinese labor abuses are very difficult to sustain when looked at in terms of the conditions of Chinese labor more generally speaking. So what we actually have in China, as in many other parts of the third world, of the developing world, is a situation where there has been a systemic tendency for wages not to rise until you reach full employment, precisely because unemployment serves as a fetter to keep wages from rising. And even if they were to rise, it would have the effect of creating a relatively privileged sector of workers producing for international export, and it would be unlikely to have much effect anyway.
Let's turn now to the general project of liberalization, trade liberalization and capital account liberalization. This was, of course, the great project of the Clinton administration. It seems to have stalled a bit in recent years. What's your evaluation? First, what is the state of trade liberalization and the WTO?
Well, right now we have the meeting of UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, going on in Sao Paulo in Brazil. Unfortunately, there are very few prospects of any significant strengthening of the original purpose of UNCTAD. UNCTAD was created during the 1960s to try to strengthen the capacity of developing countries to try to fashion trade policy in ways which would be much more effectively developmental. Not unlike some of the policies which were advocated by people like Alexander Hamilton at the beginning of after the American War of Independence. And as we know, U.S. policies and many other parts of the now developed world involved a great deal of use of trade policy to try to develop new industrial and other other economic capacities and capabilities. And it is precisely this which developing countries have tried to do as well. The current advocacy of trade liberalization, it seems to me, does not recognize two things. One, it does not recognize the importance of trade policy for trying to become internationally competitive. And this is something which has been recognized not only by Hamilton and many other late 18th century and 19th century economists, but which continues to be recognized in the current period by a whole range of advocates of strategic trade theory, including some members of the Clinton administration like Laura Tyson. Unfortunately, that is now no longer an option and is no longer supported by the international financial institutions after McNamara. The other aspect which has been extremely important is that there is very little recognition that trade liberalization would actually mean a certain enhancement of specialization which is not in the medium or long-term interests of the developing countries themselves, and has also meant the deindustrialization of many of the developing countries. This has been happening not only in Africa and certain parts of Latin America, it's beginning to happen in Asia as well, including Southeast Asia in the recent period. This is particularly important because there has been, through the 20th century, a significant secular decline in the terms of trade against primary products in favor of manufactures. There's also been a decline in the terms of trade of tropical primary products compared with temperate primary products. For example, if you look at what has happened with cotton prices compared to, say, the price of wool, and so on and so forth. The third trend, which has been extremely important in the last three decades or so, has been the decline in the terms of trade of manufactured goods coming from developing countries. We talked about China earlier, compared to those manufactured goods coming from which are still produced in the north, especially where intellectual property rights have been assured. And one should not forget that intellectual property rights have only been strengthened in the last two decades, especially since the second Reagan administration, since we are in a period of mourning for the great communicator.
Not all of us.
When Secretary of State Shultz, not coincidentally subsequently chairman of Bechtel and other corporations, played a very important role in strengthening the intellectual property rights. And this was subsequently institutionalized with the new World Trade Organization.
We're just about out of time, but a final few words on the state of capital account liberalization, movement of investment funds around the world. That was one of the passions of Rubin and Summers. They're running around the world, getting countries to open up. There was some talk after the East Asian crisis of tightening up a bit, of developing a new global financial architecture. Whatever happened with all that, and what's the state of play now?
The recognition of the need for well thought through systemic financial reform was only first articulated almost a year after the East Asian crisis began, almost around the time the Russian crisis struck Wall Street and resulted in the collapse of LTCM. In many ways, the East Asian crisis was the culmination of a process which had been advocated from the end of the sovereign debt crisis of the early and mid-1980s. And this whole process involved extension of the mandate of the IMF from the current account, which was basically the original mandate of the IMF, to include the capital account. And this was largely a process driven from Washington. Now, the liberalization of the capital account has largely meant that increasingly countries were discouraged from managing their own capital accounts. They were basically advised to leave things very much to the market, and the market would take care of things. Now, this resulted in a great number of problems, and it was only countries like like Chile and Colombia, which had some controls on inflows, which were able to moderate some of the volatility which the market often induced. And of course, the other countries such as China and India, which had controls from an earlier era, which were able to discourage such flows. But many of these old controls, if you will, were largely dismantled and withdrawn, especially by the emerging market economies, which were very anxious to have access to international capital flows. So the initial concession after the East Asian crisis by the then Deputy Managing Director, Stanley Fisher, was to say that capital controls on inflows were acceptable, but controls on outflows were a no-no. And here he referred favorably to the Chilean and Colombian experiences. However, very interestingly, last year, the managing director of the IMF, who has since resigned to become the next president of Germany, Horst Koller, basically acknowledged that controls on outflows were often a very necessary policy tool which developing country governments in particular, but countries in general, should begin to consider. All this, of course, is a very far cry from the original intent of the IMF and the original conception of the IMF, where capital accounts were to be managed by sovereign governments, and this has largely been abandoned. Now, there is now some grudging recognition of the need for capital controls in emergency situations, but the debate needs to be pressed, the issues need to be pressed to much further before we are likely to see a fuller recognition of the need for sovereign control of capital accounts. In the meantime, however, some of us have been advocating for what we would call better capital account management, since the term capital controls is such a no-no, especially in financial markets.
And that was the voice of the Malaysian economist Jomo K.S., Jomo Kwame Sundaram, known professionally as Jomo. He's a professor of political economy, I think, at the University of Malaysia, where he's been teaching since 1982. And this is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial, and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. And let's take a little musical break with the Gang of Four, and we'll be back to talk with Seth Kleinman.
People got opinions. Where do they come from?
Just another problem. Won't discover what it's all about.
This just seems like a natural fact. But what we think changes how we act. Change ideas. Change is what we do.
Too much thinking makes me ill. I think I'll have another gin. A few more drinks, it'll be alright.
Each day seems like a natural fight. And what we think changes how we act.
Continuing my journey through the 1970s, that was the Gang of Four, their song Why Theory, because each day seems like a natural fact when, of course, it isn't. And now we're joined on the line by Seth Kleinman, who is with PFC Energy, the Washington-based energy consultancy. Welcome to WBAI, Seth Kleinman.
Good evening.
So I don't have your title at PFC Energy, unfortunately.
I'm a market analyst.
Okay, market analyst. So that's what we want to do. We want to analyze the oil markets. And prices have come off their highs over the last week or so, but we're still up like 250% from the lows of a couple of years ago. So what's been driving the oil market for this rise to $40?
Well, what took crude over $40 was a combination of several things. You saw very strong product demand growth, particularly in China, but also in the U.S. SUVs take up a lot of gasoline. And in the U.S., you had this very tight gasoline market as a result of the strong demand. And through the oddities of the oil markets, very high, very expensive gasoline prices can translate into very expensive crude. That was one factor. And then more recently, what really gave it that final push to take it over $40 were these fear factors that have been so widely commented on, if rather badly quantified, where you have the strong demand growth we saw left very little global spare productive capacity. And once that spare productive capacity was targeted by insurgents or radicals or whatever the nomenclature in the Middle East, the markets got very afraid. There was the possibility of a significant supply shortfall. And that really was what combined to push prices over 40. The market has relaxed a little bit, which is why they came down below 40. But 38.50, or which is pretty close to where we closed today, is not cheap by anyone's standards.
Although it's certainly not yet near what the highs we saw in the late 1970s, early 1980s, right?
Inflation adjusted, that's right.
Now, some more excitable types are invoking the Hubbert peak and saying, you know, this is the early signs of the fact we're running out of oil.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thinking on that?
Well, it's just as interesting a proposition now as it was about 100 years ago when it was first put forward. Over the next couple of years, you're going to see a whole lot more crude coming on. You've got a lot of crude developed in the Gulf of Mexico, West Africa, the Caspian. Russia still has a lot more. There's more crude coming on. We're probably not near the global peak yet. However, you know, there will be one day. The fact that gasoline prices did cross the $2 mark does not really presage the end of the world's oil supplies.
There has been some confusion about just what exactly what the reserves are, and then Shell, of course, had to do a major restatement of its reserves, and there's been some skepticism about whether the oil companies are telling the truth about what they have. Yet, what is it, BP came out a day or two ago with their annual look at the world oil markets, and they saw plentiful reserves. So how do we read all this? Can we trust the numbers?
You can trust BP. I mean, even the Shell thing is certainly of interest to the markets, but some of the more alarmist people, and particularly the proponents of this Hubbert hypothesis, have really seized on it and made much more of it than it's worth. It really comes down to that when it comes to classifying oil reserves, there's as much art as science. It's not immediately clear whether something can be classified as proved or unproved. I mean, when you're talking about something that's several thousand feet below the surface of the Earth, a great degree of uncertainty is to be expected.
Some people have run around putting, and you alluded to this earlier, sort of putting dollar amounts on each risk factor around the world. And, of course, a very strong demand from China has also been a factor. What's your rough estimates of what these various contributions to the rise in oil price are?
I mean, that whole exercise is really more of an exercise in editorializing, really, than education. I mean, the price of oil is what it is. You can look on a Reuters screen and or read it in a newspaper. Breaking down the factors, I'm not particularly fond of doing that because, like I say, the lack of any counterfactual that would ever prove me wrong doesn't make me still very fond of doing that.
Okay. I'll excuse you for that task then. But some people speak with great authority and confidence when they come up with these numbers.
I mean, you can look at, if you look at historical norms, you look at what would generally be regarded as the greatest determinant of oil prices is where stocks are and where demand is. If I was to just look at a graph and ignore any geopolitical considerations and say, all right, this is where inventories are in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, and this is what demand's looking like, I might guess that crude was going to cost in the region of 30. Low 30s, say, and it's high 30s now. So that gives you an indication of what these other geopolitical considerations, the type of premium that they're putting on crude.
And what about Chinese demand? That's been growing very strongly. How important a factor is that?
Oh, it's huge. Even without China doing what it's doing, which is growing this year at about a million barrels a day, which is very, very significant. If you think that the U.S. uses about 20 million barrels a day of crude, China in 1 year is growing about 5% of the U.S.'s total consumption. The entire global supply chain, from production through to the tankers that ship the crude all the way around the world to the refineries that then turn it into useful products, all of these were very, very tightly stretched. There just hadn't been much investment over the last 20 years. There hasn't been a refinery built in the United States since 1976. Tanker markets were very tight. And so then you had China, just this runaway train that really stretched them. It didn't break the supply chain, but it certainly left some kinks pulled out of shape, which is why in January you saw the rates for tankerage reach historic highs. You've seen the very high prices in the U.S. in part because there's just not much, there's no spare capacity cushion on the refining side. So, and now what little global spare production capacity there is pretty much all in Saudi Arabia, and with that being targeted, coming under the getting the attention of insurgents in that region, it's a combination of all of those that really took prices where they are.
I want to come back to the Saudi issue in a bit, but why is the supply chain so tight, and why has investment been so low in recent years, and why aren't they building refineries in the United States? Is this just because they don't have the money? Is this a market strategy? They don't have faith in future profitability? What's behind it?
It's the latter. They don't have faith in future profitability as yet because historically the returns have been so dismal in the refining industry. And you know, this year that's changed, but it's a very, very pleasant exception to the rule for a lot of big oil companies. And then, well, that's one reason why you haven't seen much investment, but what really has stopped there being a refinery being built has been environmental regulations, which have made it virtually impossible. There's the NIMBY syndrome, the not-in-my-backyard syndrome. Refineries tend to do unpleasant things to the air and ground, and people don't want them around.
Now, I read the other day in the Financial Times that the U.S. consumes 45% of the world's gasoline. Is that the correct number?
It's about right, yeah.
I was stunned to read that. I'm used to us consuming 20% of the world's resources, but 45% of the world's gasoline. Is that just because we like SUVs so much?
That's a key component, yeah. Americans do drive, from a European perspective, rather peculiarly large vehicles.
To say the least.
Yeah, but there's also other factors at play. In Europe, you've really had the dieselization of the fleet. Over 60% of new cars sold in Europe use diesel. So what you have in the U.S., you have a shortage of gasoline. In Europe, you're having the development of a shortage of diesel. The two countries and the two blocks, rather, of the geographical areas are getting pretty good at swapping back and forth.
Okay, now I'm speaking with Seth Kleinman, who is a market analyst with PFC Energy based in Washington, D.C. And now let's talk a bit about Saudi Arabia. Just how vulnerable is the whole Saudi human and physical infrastructure to serious disruption?
That's a tough call. If you can fly a plane into a building, you can fly a plane into pretty much anything, and big buildings fall down, and refineries can be blown up. However, there's extraordinarily strong security in Saudi Arabia, particularly at the most important choke points. So I mean, the infrastructure is very secure, is very well defended. However, there's been a degree of determination that's become apparent to disrupt oil supplies in Iraq and in Saudi Arabia that quite justifiably has the market very worried.
And let's step back a bit and talk about the broad forces that determine oil prices. Mm-hmm. There are some people who think it's all OPEC's doing. There are some people who think it's all oil companies doing. Some people say it's the futures traders here in New York, the hedge funds who will load up on futures or dump the futures. What are the relative weights of all these factors in determining oil prices?
The hedge funds really operate at the margins. They can certainly accelerate abrupt price rises or price declines, but it's stretching it a bit to really give them credit for causing the underlying trend. Ultimately, it's supply and demand. OPEC is a big supplier. It's a cartel. They certainly have the ability and the propensity and the incentive to restrict supply to increase prices. And over time, at different parts of history, they've exhibited better or less abilities, greater or less abilities to manipulate prices. Right now, they're doing a pretty good job, but they've been dealt a very good set of cards, and they are dealing them very well in terms of keeping prices high. Oil companies don't really figure too much into the equation.
So they just price takers and somebody else sets the price?
Well, especially if you look at the majors, not only they're involved, they can make money sometimes when oil prices are high, but they may lose money on their refining operations, depending what goes on with product markets. They pretty much just have to take what's given. They don't have big enough reserves, and they don't have the spare capacity that OPEC has. It's the spare capacity that gives OPEC the ability to turn on the taps or turn it off in order to affect prices. A private oil company pretty much just runs full out.
And how much influence does the hawkish government of Chavez in Venezuela have on OPEC policy?
Well, they have the ability to influence OPEC in that you have certain members of OPEC, particularly the Venezuelans, but also the Iranians, who be very comfortable with $100 oil as political agendas at play. But then you also have members of OPEC, which include Venezuela, but also Indonesia, who are producing below their OPEC quota anyways. So they actually have nothing to lose by clamping down on the quota and getting even higher prices, because they don't have enough capacity to meet their quota as is. And so they can put a more bullish tone to the whole deliberation. But Chavez rantings about cutting off the U.S. or any of this nonsense really doesn't have much influence.
Now, $100 oil sounds tempting from an exporter's point of view, but would it drive the world into near depression and reduce demand rather severely?
Oh, sure, which is why traditionally the Saudis, both out of political considerations, given their relationship with the U.S., but also because of the fact that they know that they're in this for the long haul, they have been the price moderators in OPEC. As you've seen the first of those become less of an issue, as you've seen a souring of the Saudi-U.S. relationship, that first one has really faded away, and they've become more hawkish as a result. But they're still, they don't want $70, $60, $50 crude. But the fact that they haven't done everything they can to bring crude much below 40 shows that they may be able to sleep at night with $40 WTI.
But when they did announce that they're going to increase production, it didn't have that much of an effect on the market. Calmed things a little bit, but not too much. Is it just that they're not producing enough to make a difference?
They are producing enough to make a difference. There's a lot of crude out there right now. But you have the fact is, A, you have some strong product fundamentals, and then you do have this fear premium. And it's a truism to point out that for every increased barrel of Saudi production leaves one less barrel of spare productive capacity in the world. And that's why, say, what's going on with Iraq right now is so worrying. The fact that Saudis maintain this spare productive capacity means that they can step in and fill in the gap. For example, during the strike in Venezuela that pretty much removed Venezuela from global oil markets for a little while. If Iraq was to actually be removed from global oil markets, the Saudis couldn't cover it. It would take pretty much every single barrel of spare productive capacity in the world to fill in the void left by Iraq. So the Saudis are producing more. There is a lot of crude out there, but people are still concerned.
And there's just not enough new non-OPEC production to offset this tightness in traditional Middle Eastern suppliers?
There hasn't been much growth in that over the last few years. In fact, if you exclude Russia, there's actually been slight declines. It does get harder and harder to find oil.
So if we want to keep consuming large quantities of oil, we're going to have to depend upon the Middle East to produce it for us.
That's in the long term, that's an inevitability. In the shorter term, i.e. the next 2 to 3 years, there will be more non-OPEC supply. You'll see increases from the Caspian, from West Africa, Brazil, and the Gulf of Mexico. But once that big slug of non-OPEC supply works its way through the system and those fields go into decline, the major reserves of oil are left in the Middle East.
And let's conclude on a longer-term note. I mean, how seriously are we thinking of, as that BP slogan goes, a world beyond petroleum? Is there much serious planning and research devoted to a post-oil world, or are we still assuming that we're going to consume oil in the way and quantities we do for the indefinite future?
There certainly is extensive research being done. You know, there's billions of dollars only don't sound like much money when compared to the hundreds of billions of dollars that there is in oil, but it's still substantial, and it may well be appropriate given the time frame that we're looking at that will necessitate bringing this technology to fruition into everyday use. But there are fuel cell cars out there. They're not commercially viable right now, but they are technologically viable. People are working on hydrogen. Once oil gets stuck, if we do really start running up the Hubbard's curve, or rather running down the Hubbard's curve, and oil tends to peak at once you've depleted about 60% of a field's reserves or a country's reserves, the production tends to go into decline really quite rapidly. If we hit that point, particularly in globally, or even just if we hit that point in non-OPEC, then oil will probably become quite expensive, at which stage people will pay much more keen attention to alternatives.
And how imminent is that point, do you think?
In terms of non-OPEC, I mean, it looks like there's a fair amount of crude. Whether it'll be rising, we may well plateau up, because geopolitical considerations really come into play in evaluating this. It's not just the geology. If you look at somewhere like Russia or Mexico, you really need to take account of the above-ground in factors that will determine the rate at which they would produce and then eventually decline. We can have a fair amount of oil. The world can have a lot of oil coming out of non-OPEC countries out through easily 2010 and maybe 2020. The question is to how comfortable the world is relying on OPEC to fill the gap.
And thank you. Well, like I said, we should end there. Thank you for joining us, Seth Kleinman, who is a market analyst with PFC Energy. Thanks for your time. And that's it for Behind the News today. This is Doug Henwood, and we'll be back next week to look at the worlds of economics and politics again. And go out with a little music. This is number one in the country charts right now. A little out of left field musical offering here. Gretchen Wilson's "Redneck Woman," and I know "redneck" is sometimes an incendiary word, but she actually emerges from a group in Nashville, the Music Mafia, that is proud of being music, as one of their members said, music without prejudice. You can be a bluegrass fan, a punk rocker, a rapper, a goth chick, or a classical guy. If you love music, you're welcome. And this is a hymn to a sort of identitarian ethnic pride, a rather strange sort. But it's really a fine song, Gretchen Wilson's "Redneck Woman."